Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Could cannabis cafes be coming to a corner near you? Last month, the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission approved a pilot program for 12 communities to open social consumption sites. Here's Cannabis Control Commissioner Steve Hoffman speaking with Boston 25 News.
People are going to be able to sit with friends, whatever, and consume legal marijuana products.
But before anything can move forward, the state legislature has to intervene and tweak a law that affects how local communities would decide to participate. In the meantime, let's dig in. What do we mean by social consumption sites and what stands in the way of them opening across the strait, across the state? Joining me now from Amherst is Alyssa Brewer. Alyssa Brewer, she's an Amherst town councilor and was a part of the Cannabis Control Commission's municipal working group on social consumption. Alyssa, hello.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi there. Also with us from Amherst, Karima Risk. Karima attempted to open a social consumption site in Massachusetts. Right now, she's general manager of Holyoke Cannabis. That is a prospective retailer of recreational marijuana. Karima, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
And here with me in Studio 3 is John Carmichael, police chief in Walpole. He was formerly on the Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving. Chief Carmichael, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to hear from our guests in just a moment. But first, what do you think? Should Massachusetts allow social consumption sites or cannabis cafes? Would you have concerns about one of these sites opening in your community? Is this the same or different from a bar or some other kind of cafe? You can call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us, at Radio Boston. Okay, Karima, let's start with you. You had plans at one point to open a social consumption site. What would it have looked like? What's the closest equivalent that people might be able to imagine?
Certainly. In 2017, 2018, I attempted to open Cafe Vert, a licensed and permitted cannabis coffee house. And I was looking at kind of a mixed-use business that would combine an element of social consumption, an element of licensed retail, and also just a standalone coffee shop as well.
And the vibe, is it kind of nightclub vibe? Is it, you know, bookstore coffee shop vibe? What did you imagine? Help people really picture what this means.
Absolutely. I was looking at something that really fit with the fabric of our community out in Western Massachusetts. Something maybe perhaps a little bit more mature, a place to gather and have fact-based evidence and information, classes, value-added opportunities, and also just to gather and connect with other users in a safe, educated space. I think safety and working with the government were two of my foremost concerns when entering into this business.
Alyssa, I want to turn to you. You were on an advisory panel that studied legal social consumption sites. You must have learned a lot. What were your big takeaways?
The big takeaways, of course, were how different is this from alcohol and how is it more like a bookstore cafe and how much be like a tasting room associated with a brew pub, associated with a brewery. And we also found that each of our communities was regulating alcohol very differently. And we had different types of events in our communities and different types of brick and mortar establishments. So even amongst the communities that were sitting at that table, we realized, hey, we don't do things all the same. We need to make sure that there is a creative way of allowing people to reflect the nature of their community, whether it's a bigger city, whether it's a more tourist area, in our case, where it's a college town, where we annually welcome thousands of new students and employees from states and countries that regulate marijuana use very different, having the UMass flagship here, as well as Amherst College and Hampshire College.
So, Alyssa, with that in mind, what are the two or three most important things for the Commonwealth to do in order to create acceptable conditions for social consumption businesses?
I think the plans that have been set up in terms of they're quite restrictive in terms of what's possible to happen and what isn't. And it's very focused on data gathering, so a very small group of communities doing this to begin with, so that we can see how it works. They won't just allow one or two to start. You have to have expressed interest from at least six and then up to 12. And then there are all types of limitations that are far more stringent than limitations on restaurants and bars. So you can't bring in your family members if they're under 21. They won't be serving till 1 o'clock in the morning. There are all kinds of restrictions associated with that. So it feels like a fairly tight pilot program.
And Alyssa, just to clarify, are you saying that there weren't six cities, towns, municipalities that wanted to do it, the Commonwealth wouldn't do it?
That's the way it looks right now with the regulations that were just voted on. I think they're looking for sort of a small critical mass of groups to get together so, again, they can evaluate how it works in different communities.
So, Chief Carmichael, my understanding is you don't believe Massachusetts is ready for social consumption sites. Is that true? And if so, why not?
Well, you know, originally in the original law that social consumption piece was built into it, so we have always assumed that at some point social consumption is going to happen here in Massachusetts. However, there are still some public safety issues that have to be addressed. And being on the Cannabis Advisory Board, I kind of played it two ways. One was, I'm responsible for public safety. I'm that seat on the board. And I was going to first be against social consumption altogether until we fixed the issues with impaired driving. And then, two, if I felt that it was going to move forward and go through, that at least we built some public safety mechanisms into the regulations, which have ultimately made it in there. On this specific issue, obviously, my position is to advocate for the safety of motorists in Massachusetts. We do know that part of the Cannabis Control Commission data so far has suggested that, of the adult population, there is a significant amount of people who have self-reported driving impaired already.
You mean impaired by marijuana?
Correct. And so it's a public safety issue where we need to make sure that we don't add to an existing problem that we already have and not be irresponsible to ignore the problems that we are dealing with right now. And that's why the governor's bill that he previously began to make another push for is very important as far as, social consumption in Massachusetts.
So I'm going to want to come back and have some more conversation among all three of you about the governor's bill and the question of operating a vehicle under impairment. But I want to get some calls. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. Ed from Belmont, you are on the line. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. I really appreciate this conversation. I was delighted when marijuana was made legal for recreation in Massachusetts. I went to college in upstate New York in the 70s when it was decriminalized, and I think that's the right way to go. I think we are not really ready for social consumption, mainly because we shouldn't forget that marijuana is still against the law federally.
Federally.
And I think it's going to create a tag federally, correct. And I think we're going to create a target for whether it's the federal prosecutor or other members of the federal government that will be looking for reasons to come down hard, as they've shown to be
all right,
kind of callously indifferent to individual rights so far.
Thanks, Ed. Let's pick it up from there. So, Karima, I actually want to come to you first. You were going to build a business that was going to be legal in the Commonwealth but illegal federally. How did you think about that as an entrepreneur?
Very carefully. And I will say that I came from a pretty well-prepared background. I did work at Netta, one of the larger medical marijuana dispensaries before, and I currently work in retail, so I have a pretty good idea about the operating environment in Massachusetts for a licensed cannabis business. But I definitely worked hand in hand, and some of the things I knew, I was told I would have to work closely with my zoning board, but I never in a million years realized about the social consumption ballot committee. However, if I have the opportunity, I'd love to tell you about that because I got to be the chairwoman of the state's only social consumption ballot committee.
Well, why don't you tell us about that for a second?
Absolutely. So in East Hampton in 2018, after I had to let go of my location and just feeling frustrated, there was really nothing as a citizen I could do about the situation other than what was prescribed in the law, which was to go through the municipal ballot process to get the social consumption question on our local ballot. So I formed a committee and filed the paperwork to do so. However, when we requested to have the paperwork to start our petition process, we were denied that paperwork from the Secretary of State's office, and they cited the law was broken. So we've been caught in between the legislature, whom we've shared this with, the CCC, and the Secretary of State's office. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, let's turn to Alyssa. Alyssa, can you explain what that broken law or what that conflict is?
Oh, because your listeners are definitely fascinated by that level of litigation.
Well, they might
in process,
be.
Which is the kind of thing we thrive on town councils. But and so thank you for asking.
Yep.
So basically, the idea is that you were supposed to be able to have a community opt-in, right? That's what the legislation said.
So the community sort of is the one that gets to say, hey, we want to do this.
We want to do this. And that was way back when, right, when this was first passed as both a ballot question and then the legislature's version of the ballot question. However, in reading it, you know, I read it as then a select board member. We've recently changed our form of government in Amherst. But as a select board member, I read that as, oh, well, people can bring forward a petition just like they can bring forward a petition under any number of conditions to get things to happen. Or the select board, as the executive chief officials, can just put something on the ballot because they choose to put something on the ballot. It never occurred to me that the way it was actually written and the way the Secretary of the Commonwealth was interpreting it is that the only way it could happen is by petition and then saying, yeah, and even that part really won't work the way all your other petitions work. So sorry, we're not going to let you do that.
So and I'm sorry, so how does it work differently?
Loses. So it basically said we could not, I mean, normally one's charter and then Mass General Law tells you how you can collect signatures under different sorts of conditions, X number of signatures for this type of issue, X number of signatures within this time period.
Okay, so this is really internecine.
Exactly. Okay. And so, but they would not allow it to go forward. And so even, and they would insist, and again, that puts Karima, for example, in the position of, we have to drum up enthusiasm to get a ballot question that maybe the entire elected officials want anyway, but they can't put it on the ballot themselves because what now? So it was okay. Just one of those confusing disconnects.
Okay. Thank you for that. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. John from Katomet, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on this impaired driving bill. I'm a lawyer. And some of the provisions in the bill are terrible for civil liberties, namely mandating that police officer testimony be recognized as valid expert testimony. That's going down.
So John, I just want to check. You're talking about officer testimony regarding the state of a driver's condition when they were pulled over?
Exactly. So-called drug recognition expert.
And you find that troublesome?
Right, because there's a process for recognizing whether somebody's qualified as an expert to give scientific testimony. And historically, the police have been allowed to give all kinds of expert testimony that's been proven to be totally invalid. And that's what happened with the National Academy of Sciences study of forensic testimony.
Okay,
so this is going the wrong way and will result in
all right, John, your line is cutting out, but fortunately we happen to have a chief of police sitting right across from me. Chief, let me give you a chance to respond to John.
Well, he just supported the fact of why we shouldn't allow social consumption.
Which
he's saying that the science is invalid. However, I disagree with that. We, you know, drug recognition experts are used all over the country. They testify in courts every day.
But there is some contention over whether there are scientific studies to back up an officer's ability to recognize reliably whether somebody's under the influence.
Well, you know, this is what happened over here in Massachusetts. The Operating Under the Influence Commission, which is 13 members of people who come from various disciplines, different backgrounds, all came together and came up with 19 recommendations. After we, all of us, reviewed all of the data, all of the research, all of the science that goes along with impaired driving as far as marijuana and or other drugs are concerned. There was defense attorneys on there. There was police officers. There was the ACLU was part of this commission. And ultimately, we came up with the 19 recommendations to make to the legislature to allow for drug recognition experts to testify in court, as they do in many other states, and accept some of the science that already exists out there and let the courts decide that.
So, Chief, to clarify for our listeners, there is no such thing as sort of the breathalyzer test for marijuana. First, is that correct?
Correct.
And marijuana can stay detectable in the system for, what, like a month? So how does one have confidence that law enforcement, I mean, I know we have to solve this problem, but how does one have confidence that law enforcement can reliably detect whether or not someone's actively under the influence if they're pulled over?
Well, those are the subsequent tests that occur after the initial observations made by the police officer in the street. There's already a new case that just came out, Commonwealth versus Davis, where it established what exactly police need for probable cause to make an arrest for operating under the influence of drugs. And then once that person is brought back to the police station or the barracks, per se, they are offered a drug recognition expert evaluation. Some of that may include the ability to get oral fluids, or breath test, you know, if that ever happens in the future. And they will ultimately be able to use that in court later on. The issue with it staying in your system, marijuana is it is metabolized differently. It has different effects than, you know, say alcohol does. We don't have breathalyzer tests for heroin or cocaine or marijuana. But, this is designed to do is to give the officers some confirmatory analysis that happens after probable cause was established in the street. Add on to that later on. The issue with the marijuana being in your system for days, you know, what we need to do is test for active Delta-9 THC or hydroxy-THC, which will not stay in your system very long. And then that, again, being used as a subsequent, support of what the officer observed.
Okay, I want to bring Karima back into the conversation
here.
I'd like
to weigh in with a counterpoint, too.
Go
if
ahead.
I may.
Yeah.
I do have a lot of respect for the commission. I thank the chief for his work on that. And I agree that we need to definitely tackle this issue seriously. But I would argue that we already have the capacity to monitor and stop drivers for signs of impaired driving through the standardized field sobriety test, you know, a battery of three tests performed at traffic stops. I think it's really important to judge based on qualitative demonstrations, aspects. For example, how does the driver present themselves to the officer? What are the results of the field test? As opposed to quantitative aspects, which we simply can't measure right now. For example, how many nanograms of THC per milliliter? And I'd also like to make the argument, too, that as a complete counter perspective, I would argue that social consumption venues actually are safer for the public.
Why? Why would you say that? And Alyssa, once listen, because I'm going to ask you what you think after Karima makes her argument.
Absolutely. Well, as the chief mentioned, Chief Carmichael, that 2018 study from the Department of Public Health found that nearly 35% of adults who reported using marijuana in the past 30 days also reported driving under the influence of marijuana. The fact is, people have been driving impaired with cannabis or from cannabis use for decades. It's nothing new. The only thing that might have changed is access, with more people being able to access it.
So, Karima, why does where they consume it make it safer?
Great question. So, for a few reasons. One, by legalizing social consumption, we provide a safe place. Instead of people going to their car, which is an unfortunate area that people have had to go to because it's not allowed in private homes, for example, you know, long laundry list from, you know, millions of tourists to our over 2.6 million renters to, you know, the laundry list goes on and on, 72,000 people in Section 8 housing.
Those are all people who, for whatever reason, are not allowed to consume in their homes.
Responsible parents who choose not to, seniors, you know, veterans, homeless people, all these many people can't access legally cannabis if they are not private homeowners. So, one, it would provide a safe space off of the roads, off of parking lots, out of public parks. Two, patrons will have access to trained staff that are able to educate them on products, dosage, and safe, responsible adult consumption. And that is really what's needed. I think there tends to be a patronizing perspective of, and it comes to curb our adult civil liberties. And I think it's extremely important that there's a learning curve and that we help teach people and be there if they need us.
All right.
And
so
lastly, if I could just ask, social consumption venues can provide safer alternatives to driving, such as a taxi, discounts for Lyft or Uber, or even directing them to public transportation.
So, Alyssa, let me give you a chance to react there.
Everything she said was terrific. I mean, what it comes down to for me, to summarize what she just said, is either access matters or it doesn't. Because people don't have access now.
Say it again, Alyssa. For whom does access matter here?
It matters for medical patients who aren't allowed to use it in certain formats where they're renting. I mean, they're not technically allowed to use it at all where they're renting, but who's going to notice if they use it in certain formats is part of the question. It's access for people to consume responsibly, as Karima just left off the list. I mean, there are people who don't want to consume in front of their kids, for example. This has been over 21 space, and that's very helpful. People are now sneaking around, doing what they have to do to consume that they want to consume. Yes, it's true that a few more people are going to be consuming because it's going to be a new and happening thing, just like when we developed this wonderful brewery culture all through Massachusetts. A lot more people went and started trying different kinds of beer, driving hours to try different kinds of beer, and they don't have a way home. And breathalyzers aren't perfect, and they don't exist yet for marijuana.
So let me turn to the chief there and say, Chief Carmichael, there is an argument here that folks will have access, that mm-hmm. there are people, for example, somebody who's in Section 8 housing, who from a civil rights standpoint should also have access. And without a social consumption site, they won't. How, from a law enforcement perspective, does that resonate at all with you? And how should one think about that?
Oh, sure, it does. You know, and as part of the, you know, as a member of the Cannabis Advisory Board, we had all of these discussions, and both speakers just made very good, valid points on that side of the issue. However, you know, you just still can't ignore the fact that we're balancing somebody's access to marijuana and, you know, operating a motor vehicle. Yes, there are people. It has happened for years. People have driven impaired. But we have to be very careful with that and not making it worse. If you look at Colorado, last year they had 109 fatal crashes involving marijuana only. Of those 109 fatal crashes, 83 had active THC in their system at the time of the crash.
What about Karima's argument that people have been driving under the influence of marijuana before it was legal? This won't necessarily change those numbers.
Well, we don't know that. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But, again, that's the argument, is that, you know, we're weighing access and use to, you know, public safety in the roadways. And I get that perspective. I understood that when I was on the advisory board. As a police chief, as a public safety official, I also have to weigh the other side. I have to advocate for the people that are out there driving on our roads and keeping them safe.
Okay, we've had some callers waiting. I want to try to get one caller voice in here. Lisa from Newton, you've been waiting. Thanks. Go ahead.
So I'll just say quickly that the THC that we are talking about, that people have been doing for years, had a very different level of THC, the pot. So when you're talking about people driving and getting stoned for years, that's very different than the product now, which is genetically modified and has a much higher level of THC in it. The reason I called in, though, is I live in a town where we voted to opt in by about 2,000 votes. And we took the question, the ballot question that was asked of us, very, very seriously, and we wanted our town to reconsider opting in. And so we got over 6,000 signatures, and we tried to get a healthy vote, meaning do we want to have pot stores, yes or no, or do we not? The marijuana industry, the cannabis industry, the stores that want to come into my town, which is in Newton, spent over $400,000 to try and stop that question. It was very politically heated.
So, Lisa, I need you to drive right to that main point for me, because I've got only a little time.
So what I would say is I do not agree with the pot industry now saying, well, you were going to have to individually by communities invite stores in, but instead you're saying we're going to change the law now, and if you were an opt-in town, yes, you can have pot lounges.
Okay,
without
I'm going to take it back from you there, Lisa. Sorry to interrupt you, but we just have limited time, and I want to give both Alyssa and Karima a chance to respond, maybe 30 seconds each for the two of you. Alyssa, how about you first?
Terrific. So again, I mean, we also, as public official, as a town councilor, I'm not the mayor, right? So I don't get to decide. It's not just my decision. We have to have the opt-in legislation first, and that's different than what people were talking about associated with retail stores in general. It's a completely separate issue. There has to be zoning that allows for it, because our zoning currently says there will be no delivery and there will be no social consumption. So we get to figure out as a community where we think it fits. And I think that's so important that each individual community gets to sort that out. Newton does not have to choose to have any social consumption facilities. That's not something they're being forced to do.
All right, let me give it to Karima now, just so she can get a last word in. Karima, go ahead.
I agree with Alyssa, and I think one of the beauties of the law in Massachusetts is that they have local control guiding this process. So there is a very thorough vetting process at the special permitting level for communities to additionally as a stopgap to prevent institutions like a cannabis coffee house to come to their community if that's something they don't want.
Okay, and Chief Carmichael, very quickly, the key next step in your mind is?
Prevention.
All right.
I'd like to remind people that, using marijuana does impair motor function. It reduces attentiveness. It slows your reaction time when you're driving. It diminishes that capacity to drive safely. And, I'd just like to ask that people remember that and take note.
All right. John Carmichael, Police Chief in Walpole, thanks so much. And Karima Risk had attempted to open a social consumption site in Massachusetts, now General Manager of Holyoke Cannabis. Thanks, Karima.
Thank you.
And Alyssa Brewer. She's an Amherst Town Counselor and was part of the Cannabis Control Commission's Municipal Working Group on Social Consumption. Thanks to you, too.
Thanks so much for having us.
Stay tuned. Thanks for the conversation. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.